From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. No doubt if you went somewhere this weekend, you noticed traffic is back to pre-pandemic levels. More people are venturing out and a lot of vaccinated folks are going about life without masks. About 25 states have vaccinated at least half of their populations. Almost 62% of Maine's population is fully vaxxed. But what about areas of the country not doing so well? For instance, Mississippi, which has only vaccinated about a third of its population. What does that mean for the rate of infection and travel to and from those states? Let's bring in Dr. Michael Osterholm. He's director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota and a frequent Here and Now guest. Doctor, welcome back.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Yes, thanks for being here. Well, let's start with vaccination rates. 85% of people over 65 now have at least one dose. That sounds like we're doing well, are we?
Well, when you look at the age-related vaccination program, we are doing quite well. We'd sure like to see two doses in that group of 85%, and we'd love to obviously take that all the way to 100%. But where we're most concerned is in the younger population, particularly those 20 to 40 years of age, and in some areas of the country where we have counties in some of the southern states where less than 20% of the population has been vaccinated. So these pockets of under-vaccination really represent potential for surges in cases in the days ahead.
In talking about those places to the south, like Mississippi and Alabama, does that mean we can expect outbreaks there, more outbreaks? What about travel? How do the low vaccination rates impact the rest of the country?
Well, we have to admit that there are some questions that we can't answer at this time. For example, last April, when this new variant from the United Kingdom, B.1.1.7, emerged here in the United States, we anticipated it would do what it had done in Europe, where we saw it sweep from country to country with major impact. And here in the United States, we only saw it really hit Michigan and Minnesota in any significant way. We can't explain why it didn't hit the other states, even though they had very low levels of vaccination. And I think one of the things we are all keeping our eye on is, well, if you look at last year, if you look at the southern states, they were basically houses on fire in that July time period, where we at one point had well upwards of 70,000 cases reported a day. Then we saw them again, a house on fire in January, where we got up to 300,000 cases a day in this country, all the southern states. Is that going to happen again this summer in those states that are under-vaccinated? Surely they have enough people that are susceptible to the virus that if you look at what happened in Michigan, for example, many of those states are still not vaccinated at the levels they were in Michigan when that surge right. took off in April. So I think that we do have to anticipate we're going to see these surges occur, but when and why they occur, we're not completely sure. But we know that if you vaccinate your populations, that is the number one thing you can do to prevent these surges from occurring.
Right. It's the number one thing you can do. But do you expect at some point the vaccine push will actually catch on in those harder to convince areas?
You know, at this point, we don't have any evidence that it's going to catch on. I think this is going to be a house by house, person by person effort. And, you know, there's not just one reason why people aren't getting vaccinated. Some are truly raising questions about the safety of the vaccine. Others don't believe that the pandemic is real and that there is no way for whatever personal reasons they're going to get vaccinated. Other people still have had challenges getting to vaccination clinics, meaning that particularly those who live alone, those who are older and elderly. There are a number of reasons why we still have a lot of outreach work to do there. So one of the things that the administration has really put an emphasis on is we go at this in every possible way. Don't just use one way. Don't just use community clinics. Just don't use community workers. Bring in every different way you can to get people vaccinated. And then just hopefully we can educate and provide enough information to answer those questions of people who doubt that they should either get vaccinated or about the safety of the vaccine. And I think that, you know, those efforts can surely increase vaccination, but we may be left with, unfortunately, a sizable portion of some areas of our country under-vaccinated.
I have just under 30 seconds with you. We're hearing that places like Oregon are asking people for evidence of full vaccination if they want to enter businesses like shops and museums, et cetera. Do you expect that more states will take on this requirement, and do you agree with this idea?
Well, mark my word, it's going to happen. It is going to happen. I mean, think about this. We saw in the age of the smoking in restaurants and bars that people said, oh, no, if we prohibit that, the bars and restaurants will shut down. You know what? We saw that those 70% of people who didn't smoke couldn't wait to get to the bars or restaurants when that happened. I think you're going to see here many of the public locations are going to ultimately come to the pressure of the public who are vaccinated and said, I want to go eat, or I want to go fly in a plane, or I want to go to a concert, knowing that the people there are vaccinated. So I think you're going to see a lot more of this discussion in the days ahead.
Dr. Michael Osterholm, Director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. As always, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Secretary of State Antony Blinken heads to the Middle East today to press Israelis and Palestinians toward long-stalled peace talks after that 11-day air war that killed more than 250 people, mostly Palestinians. Last week's ceasefire brought some relief, but there is a full-blown humanitarian crisis in the Palestinian territory of Gaza. The UN reports that more than 1,000 homes were destroyed by Israeli bombing. Hospitals and other healthcare facilities were damaged, including a COVID-19 testing center. Thousands of Palestinians were displaced, and many continue to struggle as volunteers and workers push to bring water and electricity back online. Matthias Schmala is director of the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees in the Near East. He joins us from Gaza. Matthias, what do you see?
Well, a bit more than 2 days now after the ceasefire, there remains a sense of relief. There is growing, I think, a sense of worry that this is not it. You know, I've had many colleagues, Palestinian colleagues, that is, talk to me about this was round four, implying there will be round five. And then I think the most serious impact, and for me the biggest part of what you refer to as humanitarian crisis, is the damage on people. You know, a colleague described this to me as an attack on our soul. Another one said, if you think I'm feeling okay and I'm normal, I'm not. And if anyone tries to tell you they're normal, please be skeptical, because you just cannot, as an adult or a child, live through four wars like this and think it's normal.
Yeah. Well, give us some context. This was a people already impoverished because of Israeli and Egyptian blockades to stop the flow of any possible arms to the militant group Hamas, which rules Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. And we know that, for instance, after the 50-day war in 2014, international donors, you know, pledged $2.7 billion in reconstruction assistance. But critics of Hamas say that they either, you know, take those funds for militant means, or they just can't properly govern. What do you think is most needed, and do you trust the governorship there to carry it out?
So what is most needed from my perspective is the following. Number one, the thousands of homeless need to be supported through a transition period until their homes can be rebuilt or repaired. And we will try as UNRWA to support those among them who are registered refugees with us, with a kind of transitional cash for rent arrangement probably, and we'll then try and help them rebuild in a self-help manner. That's one big need. I think a second big need, and we're really looking into that, we have 285,000 children in our schools. 20 of the 60 children killed were in our schools. So there's huge mental health support needs. So we're trying to organize that for our schools. And I really think mental health support cannot be underestimated. And then thirdly, led by the UN, and we're part of that, the World Bank and the EU, a comprehensive damage assessment is being planned, for example, of the health infrastructure. And on that basis, we'll then have to develop plans and budgets. As to your question on do I trust the people here, it's not a question of trust. What I can tell you is that in post-2014 and in my 3.5 years here, we have been able to fully account for the resources being given to us. I obviously cannot claim that for all the aid that comes into Gaza, but the aid we control is used for the right purposes.
Yeah. I almost hate to ask this next question because, as you said, the people there seem like in an unbearable state, and have been for a while, but then this, you know, incredible bombing, entire families wiped out. But is there any sense that, especially with social media, in this most recent convulsion of violence in the region, there's such an awareness, is there any sense that this time maybe some of the larger problems, moving towards some kind of two-state solution, some kind of help for people who've been sort of frozen there, something might happen?
You know, there is a hope that it will, for sure. And I think one reason for that is that the U.S. administration is at least talking to both sides. As you know, the previous one wasn't talking to both sides. So I think the U.S. has regained some credibility as a broker or mediator, and that gives people some optimism. But there's also a lot of skepticism. I think I mentioned earlier, quite a few colleagues are referring to this as round four. And, you know, 73 years or so after, as they see it, the Palestine refugees, they were kicked out of their land or their forefathers were. There is a growing sense of a solution just not being around the corner that will prevent further violence. So it's hope mixed with a healthy dose of skepticism and realism.
Matthias Schmala, director of the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees in the Near East, speaking to us from Gaza. Matthias, thank you very much. Best to you.
Singapore was seen as a success story. The island nation had done a good job throughout this pandemic of keeping COVID-19 at bay, taking actions like sealing its borders. But the nation is now facing a sharp increase in infections. Michael Sullivan reports.
Just last month, Singapore edged out another island nation, New Zealand, in Bloomberg's COVID resilience ranking. Singapore was also preparing to host the World Economic Forum, the annual meeting usually held in Davos, Switzerland. Not anymore.
This is a very critical period for all of us in our fight against COVID-19.
That's Finance Minister Lawrence Wong, who co-chairs Singapore's COVID-19 task force, speaking after the city-state announced the return of stringent containment measures. They include work from home, a ban on in-restaurant dining, and no social gatherings of more than two people. The measures come after the city-state earlier this month posted its highest daily infection rates since September, with some of the new cases coming from a cluster at the international airport.
We know that the new variants are much more infectious than what we had to deal with last year. And there is growing evidence that the new variants can spread through aerosolized particles, which means that all the precautions we are used to, in fact, may not be sufficient to safeguard against the spread of the virus.
Singapore has vaccinated more of its residents than almost any other country in Asia, more than 30% of the population. But, like others, is facing a shortage of vaccines, even as new cases are increasing.
Yes, that's quite true. We have a pipeline, but it's not an elastic pipeline. Everyone would like more, but obviously there's an international finite number of vaccines available.
Professor Dale Fisher tracks infectious diseases at the National University of Singapore. And because of that gap in supply and demand, Singapore has decided to increase the time between residents' first and second shots by 2 to 3 weeks in order to get more first jabs into more arms during the sudden rise in infections.
You don't lose anything by delaying the second jab. And in fact, some evidence is you could get a heightened immune response. The English did it and showed great efficacy with one jab. I think they were out to 12 weeks for their second jab.
Singapore's government remains publicly confident it can put a lid on this latest outbreak if its new lockdown measures are successful. For NPR News, I'm Michael Sullivan in Chiang Rai, Thailand.
Amazon's new heralded series, The Underground Railroad, is deeply disturbing. But director Barry Jenkins' view of slavery in The Underground Railroad, based on Colson Whitehead's book, is both horrifying and startlingly beautiful and redemptive. The enslaved black characters seem to radiate light even as they're brutalized. There's a real underground train, just like Jenkins pictured as a kid when he first heard there was an underground network of people helping runaways escape. Jenkins' work lays bare the trauma of what they went through. It follows Cora, who decides to flee a plantation. As she explains, her mother left her as a child during her escape.
I ain't no kind of look. The only kind I was rotten. the kind that caused a woman to run away in the middle of the night and leave her only child.
We will see a forest of lynching victims, a runaway burned alive. It's a gut punch. How must it have been for the actors? Director Jenkins said at one point he had to leave the set. Well, he brought a mental health professional on board to help him and the cast and crew. Kim White is a practicing therapist in Georgia and was the on-call, on-set counselor for the Underground Railroad. Welcome.
Hello.
Well, you are Black. You are a counselor. You're not unfamiliar with racial trauma. But this, you know, how did you prepare for this? Was there someone you could consult with?
I could not find anyone, a trauma therapist who had worked on any kind of films. I couldn't find a precedent. So Actually, that speaks highly for Barry and for Amazon Studios.
Who decided that they wanted you there. Well, what did Jenkins, Barry Jenkins, the director, say he wanted you to do?
Barry is, he's so to the point and he's so concise. His instructions were pretty simple. Kim, take care of my people.
And what did that mean for you? I mean, had you read Whitehead's book?
I had seen the script. My big focus was to be there for them in the moment, however they needed me to be. They might be triggered or confronted with a challenging situation.
We want to warn listeners. We're going to talk about exactly what made you necessary in these scenes. In the first episode, a slave owner hangs a captured runaway from chains, has him whipped to a pulp. And this is in front of his white dinner party guests. It was a form of entertainment. And then the slave owner sets this captured runaway on fire with the other enslaved plantation workers brought together as he quotes the Bible to them. Let's listen.
Let all who are under a yoke as slaves regard their own masters as worthy of all honor, so the name of God and the teachings may not be reviled. Those who have believing masters must not be disrespectful on the ground that they are brothers. Rather, they must serve all the better.
This is just, I mean, I know, Kim White, that this actor was in a harness. He wasn't really hanging. He wasn't set aflame. But what was that day like on the set?
Well, when we started out the day, Barry gave the crew, the cast, he gave them some instructions, letting them know that I was there for them. I spoke to everyone as well. And everyone knew that if they needed to stop, if they needed to step away, if they needed anything, we would have to stop. Their mental health had to come first. And that was the motto. Even on the set, between takes, Barry allowed me to go around to check on people to make sure that everybody was okay, because he knew that that was challenging.
It's not just that horrific image. I mean, there were others, the casual violence, children struck with a cane as if it was swinging a baseball bat. Horrific. And then the terror. It really shows what terror is, that nothing may be happening, but it might any second. What were some other moments, if you could describe, that were just too hard?
There was a scene in North Carolina that was really difficult. There was a town where no Blacks were allowed, and they were hung. Some of the cast and crew had, they had difficulty with that, and we talked about it.
What were some of the feelings they had to work through with you?
A lot of people had to process it. There was some anger, some feelings of sadness. A lot of people were given history lessons. Some people did not know the history of slavery.
Tuso Mbedu, who plays Cora exquisitely, has said you helped her with meditation so that she could sleep at night after the horrors of the day. Another actor told the LA Times he wished he'd used your services because he, in one scene, had a rage so intense, you know, coming through his character, that he thinks he might have blacked out. And we also understand that some of the white actors who have to play these, I mean, there's such a whiff of evil about them, that they also needed help.
Absolutely. I mean, they are human. there was a person who was telling me how he just didn't like what he had to do and this person that he had to portray. And I was saying, well, you know what? There were people there who were acting as well, who didn't like what they had to do. They would actually be in danger if they didn't do these things. And we talk. Everyone was affected by everyone else and by the material. Those who weren't affected by it were concerned about others who might be. So they were saying to me, Kim, could you go check on such and such?
Were there Black actors trying to process anger at the white actors because of their characters?
I came across that, and we would do grounding exercises, and we would talk about who this person is versus who the character is. And sometimes they would, you know, they were really angry at the past and angry at the institution of slavery, not really the people who were standing in front of them. So that was what they would need to process.
Well, and interestingly, if they were playing the part of enslaved people, they could not put that in their character. They had to swallow it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Barry was, at one point he did tell people that it would come through. At this point in time, we do show anger, but they couldn't back then. What I was hearing, there's a story of courage in this. There's a story of spirit, just in the way that that the cast and the crew were treated. There's some dignity, even in the most, as we tell the most inhumane stories.
What would you say, Kim White, again, as a mental health counselor, to African Americans in particular who might be thinking, I really want to watch this, but the past year has been so traumatic, I don't know if I can watch this?
I would say take your time. I would say, yes, watch it. I would say it's worthy, but watch it at your pace. That goes to everybody. And if you need to pause it or you need to stop, just take it in, think about it, and stop. But then you can watch the rest at another time.
Kim White, on-set mental health counselor for the new Amazon series, The Underground Railroad. Kim, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
What happens after a police officer shoots someone who's unarmed? For decades in California, internal affairs investigations, how the police themselves, were secret. Until now. Listen to On Our Watch, a podcast from NPR and KQED.
The West Coast is in the midst of a drought, and a good spring snowmelt could bring some relief by helping to fill streams and reservoirs. But in this piece that first aired on Weekend Edition, Michael Elizabeth Sackis of Colorado Public Radio reports that a warming climate and the effects of the drought are putting millions of people at risk of a water shortage.
There's still snow in some of Colorado's mountains. Brian DeMonco, supervisor of the Colorado Snow Survey, glides through trees on skis.
We are near the headwaters of the South Platte River to figure out how much snowpack we have that's left to run off into our streams, rivers, and reservoirs.
To do this, DeMonco's jabs a tall metal pipe into the snow to collect a core sample. The snowpack here is over 100% of what's normal for this time of year. But that's not the case for most of Colorado, or the West. In the southwest corner of Colorado, snowpack is at less than 30%. DeMonco says there's a concerning trend that goes back to last year's near-record heat.
That might be the real wow factor for me, where these soil moisture deficits and low stream flows that we're seeing in the fall prior are having such a massive impact on the current year's streams.
Climate change is disrupting the system in a number of ways. Unusually dry soils absorb a lot of the water that melts from the snowpack, which means that water isn't making it to rivers.
Even if we had a good snowpack year that was above normal, it may not really boost us out of that shorter term drought. And that's where I think some of our concerns for us as professionals, the deeper we get, we wonder if we're able to get out of it.
Overall, the trend shows less snowpack accumulation due to warmer temperatures. What does collect melts sooner and faster, which means less snow on the ground and a greater chance for wildfires. Becky Bollinger is the assistant Colorado State climatologist. She says unusually dry soil means
we are starting with a deficit that needs to be made up. You realize in order to have a normal runoff season and get what you need into the reservoirs, you need above average snowpack.
Two big reservoirs of concern are Lake Powell and Lake Mead in Arizona and Nevada. The forecasted inflows for Lake Powell from the Colorado River is around a third of average.
This wouldn't be a concern if Lake Powell and Lake Mead had more water in them, but they are already at critically low levels.
It's likely the federal government will declare a formal water shortage in the coming months in the Colorado River Basin, which means mandatory water cutbacks in some states. For parts of Colorado, snowpack is the reservoir. Sonia Chavez is the manager of the Upper Gunnison River Water Conservancy District. The area has around half of its normal snowpack, and life is hard for ranchers. Chavez says 3 years of back-to-back drought means there's less hay.
This year, we're starting to see our producers reduce their number of their cattle herd, and that has trickling economic effects throughout our basin.
Chavez says water managers are planning for worst-case scenarios. She says more people have moved to the Gunnison area because of a boom in remote work with the COVID-19 pandemic. Some of the well water rights on those homes are newer.
For some of those junior water right holders, they just may not get their water at all, which is a concern.
The last time the drought was this bad was in 2002. Chavez says with the poor snowpack numbers, water managers think this year could be worse. For NPR News, I'm Michael Elizabeth Sakis in Denver.
One of music's biggest festivals is returning to Grant Park in Chicago. The Foo Fighters, along with artists like Post Malone and Miley Cyrus, will take to the Lollapalooza stage at the end of July, perhaps a sign the world is anticipating getting back to normal. But the start of festival season is no consolation prize for venues like bars and small clubs, also devastated by the loss of business during this pandemic. Joe Shanahan of the Metro and Katie Tutton of the Hideout spoke with me back in January, shortly after Congress passed the Save Our Stages Act. That's $15 billion to help keep independent venues afloat. Well, now it's May and the two are still waiting. The Small Business Administration says grant approvals are actually on the way this week, but real money in bank accounts could still be a ways away. Katie Tutton, co-owner of The Hideout, and Joe Shanahan of The Metro both join us now. And Joe, last time we spoke, you gave this somewhat hopeful sentiment that essentially it's been hard, but help was on the way. You also felt like you had a seat at the table in getting this legislation passed. You had a hand in how the money was actually given out. What happened, Joe?
Well, I think the last time we talked, my colleague Katie had said, we're taking a deep breath. And quite honestly, we're just waiting to exhale at this point. 450 plus days closed, 15 months, or so in the making, losing key staff on a daily basis and a weekly basis to other sectors of business. Jobs are really what we're talking about at this point and how to get our staff back to work.
There was a sense the last time we spoke that the city's venues were banding together to get this legislation passed. But as the months pass and no help comes, is it every person for themselves now? Can you paint a picture of how Chicago's venues are doing, Katie?
Oh, no way. We are all in this together. We have just become stronger together. And we continue to work in partnership with the city, the state, and the federal government. Now we are very focused on getting our community vaccinated. So a number of us have, registered to be vaccine ambassadors and such. So just someone said this to me yesterday, and it rings so true. Just because you've done the work doesn't mean the work is done. So we still,
I mean, to tag on to what Katie is saying, Tonya, you know, there were 25,000 applications opened, 14,000 of them started, and only 11,000 submitted. So that will show you that the SBA has got their hands full while we are diligently talking to Congress on a daily basis to make sure that we are not forgotten, but we are diligently looking at making sure that we can get our staff and our patrons back in our venues safely as soon as possible.
Right. That's the number one priority. And now Lollapalooza is on for the summer. Pitchforks Festival is also happening. And as of right now, COVID guidelines for festivals right now is overall unclear. Is that frustrating, seeing these big shows return to normal somewhat, but it could overshadow the pain that maybe you're going through?
I'm hopeful because, Tonya, both Lollapalooza, Pitchfork, Smokeout, they have asked that participants be vaccinated or have a COVID test. So we're hoping by those festivals encouraging people to have vaccines, it'll help our entire community.
Well, the last time we spoke with you, you painted this dire picture of the Hideout's finances. You said you only had months. I'm curious what the picture looks like now. How have you held on?
We have held on, and again, by all the wonderful support from our community and people who have bought our merchandise. And we recently also received a grant from the Live Music Society. So that was very encouraging. I just want to, Tonya, I wanted to underscore something Joe said earlier about the Shuttered Venues Operator Grant. When we got some data, 64% of those who applied for the funds had less than 10 full-time employees. So we are really talking about small businesses here. And 40% had lost 90% or more of their revenue. You know, it's very clear that these are mom-and-pop shops that need this assistance now because, you know, as our colleagues always say, you don't just turn on the lights. You have to book these tours. You have to order the beer. You have to get in and really clean your venue before you can open. So we are very anxiously awaiting the SBA's awarding of these funds.
What you're laying out for us, though, is what you both are so used to doing. You've been doing it for decades. But this new role that you play, you all are really kind of on the front lines. I just envision every day you're on the phone, you're on Zoom, you're talking with other venue owners. Is that a true picture?
Every
Tonya,
15
that is
minutes.
Exactly, it's a very clear picture because I was on the phone with the senator of in the state of Illinois at 8 a.m. this morning to start my day talking to a senator as opposed to starting my day talking to an agent or a manager about booking a show. So that is very true. It is important that you understand and your listeners understand is that, you know, we're now in the public confidence building business. We're trying to build confidence among people to go back out, buy tickets, be ready to come back into venues as we reopen. But clearly this is all about safety and for staff and for patrons as well as the artist.
Have there been any moments where you wanted to close down completely or just throw in the towel?
I just take the towels down to the washer and dryer. I'm not throwing any towels in.
But what I do is I call Joe and or other colleagues, and they kind of calm me down. And then my husband and I put an album on and dance in the living room, and then find joy in that.
Tonya, the realization of what the National Independent Venue Association has done for us across the country, talking to people in California and New York, but also like smaller markets around the country, not just Nashville and Austin, but across the country, that truly helps. I just want to say that it is about community. It is about friends, you know, and even some family members that have stepped up to help in any way, shape, or form to support the small music venues across the city of Chicago. The community is aware that we're in an unsustainable position. But clearly, the SBA needs to act soon to make sure that we can pivot from survival to reopening.
Mm-hmm. Joe, you mentioned the sheer amount of applications that the SBA has received, but have you gotten any indication on why it's taking so long?
From what we understand, you know, they've built this model or this platform from the ground up with a change of administration and a change of leadership, even at the SBA. We understand those aspects of it. I think that the scrutiny comes to potential fraud. We understand the scrutiny, but what we don't understand is that, like for Metro or for Hideout or for the handful of, you know, civil members that I'm really close to, it is very clear that we're live music venues. And, you know, this, the timing on this is now just critical, absolutely critical.
You're learning a lot of lessons about potentially new ways to do things once you're able to see things more clearly.
Absolutely.
We're a scrappy group. We, you know, we're promoters, we're venue owners. We look at things, you know, no one gave us a business manual on how to keep a business afloat for 15 months without revenue. I mean, we figured some things out, absolutely.
Are there any last words that you all would like to say? What are your efforts focused on today as you think about getting people vaccinated? You could think about the clarity around being able to have people in your venues. What are some other things that you're focused on in this moment?
Well, one of the things that I'd like to close on is that our marquee, which is seen by, you know, 40 to 50,000, you know, cars every day, says, get vaccinated. We are ready when you are. We're going to do this right. We're going to do this safely. But these SBA funds are absolutely mandatory and necessary for us to really make that turn.
That was Joe Shanahan, owner of the Metro, and Katie Tutton, owner of the Hideout, two independent live music venues in Chicago. Katie and Joe, thank you so much for this update and our best to you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tanya.
So, are you finding it hard to let go of the mask? Of the many divisions in this country, one has been the anti-maskers versus the mask believers, some of whom are finding it hard to take it off as states drop restrictions. Remember last March when Texas became the first state to end its mask mandate? President Biden was one of many who thought more vaccinations would be needed. He asked for patience.
And the last thing we need is the Neanderthal thinking that in the meantime, everything's fine. Take off your mask. Forget it. It still matters.
Well, no one wants to be a Neanderthal or tall, but there was no spike in COVID-19 cases and deaths in Texas following that reopening. COVID-19 hospitalizations are at the lowest numbers in 11 months. Now, does that mean masks don't matter? No. But it may mean that mandates don't matter. Let's bring in Derek Thompson to explain. He's staff writer at The Atlantic. He visits us every Monday to get us thinking. Hi, Derek.
Hi there.
And as you write, the science is absolute. Masks are effective in preventing the spread of COVID-19. There's analysis and meta-analysis. You write there could have been other things happening in Texas, like hot weather that suppressed COVID. But what is interesting, and probably what is the answer here, is what people did after the mask mandate was dropped. Talk us through.
Sure. Look, I am one of these people who believes that masks absolutely do work. The question, however, is when they are actually doing that work. So, you know, I've said before that, you know, I wear masks when I go inside into crowded places, like a CVS, for example. But I am not as big of a fan of wearing masks outside, where I think it's a little bit more like wearing a seatbelt in a parked car. It is a safety measure that isn't doing that kind of work. So there's this broad question about how exactly masks work. And then there's this question of mask mandates. That's what we're looking right here at the Texas example. Texas lifted this mask mandate. Liberals, including President Joe Biden, predicted that there would be catastrophe. And there just wasn't really. Cases in Texas just plunged the exact same way they plunged in California, the exact same way they plunged in New York and in Virginia, and just about everywhere else where mask mandates were still in effect. So I think this should make us question question, in the big picture, how much do we really know about how effective policy is at determining individual behavior? And then second, you know, how do people exactly make up their own minds about how to wear a mask? It doesn't seem to be the case in the case of Texas that the policy impacted people's individual decisions. Liberals kept their masks on in the Texas cities, and in rural places in Texas, they'd already ditched their masks and throw them in the trash. They remained there firmly ensconced in that garbage.
This is exactly the point. People did what they'd been doing previously. Nothing changed. You know, so if cases were dropping, they were dropping naturally through whatever reasons. People who wore masks still wore masks. People who didn't, didn't. What does this tell us about policies, right, so even CDC guidelines? Yeah.
That's right. So there was this new paper by economists at Bentley University and San Diego State University that inspired this paper. It basically looked at the end of the Texas mask mandate and said, well, okay, what changed? The answer is nothing. Mask wearing didn't change. Employment didn't change. Mobility around the state didn't change. Basically, everyone kept on doing exactly what they kept on doing even after this mask mandate was lifted. The big picture here is that this tells me that the way that people are making up their minds is that they're choosing what to do. They're deciding what to do not just based on what the government is saying or what the CDC just said yesterday, but based on a sort of complex jambalaya of factors. They're looking at their friends to see what they're doing. They're making up their mind based on, you know, their political orientation. You have liberals throughout the last year being much more careful, being much more cautious during this pandemic than Republicans, according to surveys. And so it's this complex jambalaya that's determining people's behavior, not just this on-off switch that the government controls. That, to me, is the big takeaway from this Texas mask mandate paper.
Yeah, yeah. And the one quarrel I'd have with your article, you make it plain that there are other factors besides the partisan political ones, and you do attribute what a lot of people do to partisan politics. But, you know, I don't think that's true of many mask wearers. I think, and I've been asking people myself, many are wearing them still with mandates dropped because they also prevent allergies and colds. You know, I mean, they've gotten used to the mask as sort of a just a general prevention.
This is a great point. The fact that politics tends to be very predictive of whether or not someone is wearing a mask doesn't mean that everyone who wears a mask is some robot who is only behaving the way they're behaving because of the box they checked in November. That's not what I'm suggesting. I'm just saying that the gap we see between Republicans and Democrats is large enough that political orientation tends to be the single most predictive thing of masking behavior. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not necessarily going to the case of whether or not people should be wearing masks. It's clear that masks are pretty good for preventing aerosolized diseases like coronavirus, like we think maybe other colds and flus. And it's also the case that a lot of people, especially in, say, the Northeast or the Mid-Atlantic, where you and I live, have found that masks are really effective at blocking allergies. So there's lots of reasons to wear masks, but in terms of what predicts it, it does tend to be political orientation.
Right. Boy, and people who write policy are going to be looking long and hard at this example. You know, maybe people aren't paying as much attention to them as they think. They're doing it on their own. Derek Thompson, staff writer at The Atlantic, thank you.
Thank you.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.